It was the time of the evening prayers, and the man who called himself Kadem al-Jurf performed his ritual ablutions in the salt waters of the lagoon. Once he was cleansed, he climbed to a high place on the rocks above the ocean. He spread his prayer mat, recited the first prayer, and made the first prostration. For once, neither the act of worship nor submission to the will of God could calm the anger that seethed within him. It required all his self-discipline and dedication to complete the prayers without letting his unruly emotions mar them. When he'd finished, he built a small fire from the faggot of wood he had gathered on the way up the hill. When it was burning brightly, Kadem sat cross-legged on the mat in front of it and gazed through the curtain of shimmering heat at the glowing wood. Rocking slightly, as though he were riding a racing camel across the desert, he recited the 12 mystical shura of the Quran and waited for the voices. They had been with him since childhood, since the day of his circumcision. Always they came to him clearly after praying or fasting. He knew they were the voices of God's angels and of his prophets. The first to speak was the one he dreaded most. "You have failed in your task." He recognized the voice of Gabriel, the avenging archangel, and quailed before the accusation. Highest of the high, it was not possible that Al-Salil could spurn the bait that was so carefully prepared for him, he murmured. "Hear me, Kadem ibn Abu Bakr," said the angel. "It was your overweening pride that led you into failure. You were too certain of your own powers." The angel used his true name, for Kadem was the son of Pasha Abu Bakr, the general Dorian had slain in the battle on the banks of the river Lunga 20 years before. Pasha Abu Bakr had been the half-brother and boon companion of Zayn al-Din, the Caliph of Oman. They had grown up together in the Zenana on Lamu Island, and it was there that their destinies had first become entangled with those of Dorian and Yasmini. Much later, in the palace at Muscat, when their royal father was dead and Zayn al-Din was caliph, he had appointed Abu Bakr supreme military commander and a pasha in the service of the caliphate. Then he had sent Abu Bakr with his army to Africa to hunt down and capture Dorian and Yasmini, the incestuous runaway couple. At the head of his cavalry squadrons, Abu Bakr had caught up with them as they were trying to escape down the river Lunga and reach the open sea in Tom's tiny ship, the Swallow. Abu Bakr had attacked them while they were stranded on the sandbar at the mouth of the river. The battle was fierce and bloody, with Abu Bakr's cavalry squadrons charging through the shallows. But the ship had been armed with cannon, and Dorian had touched off the blast of grapeshot that blew off Pasha Abu Bakr's head and drove off his troops in disarray. Although Kadem had been an infant at the time of his father's death, Zayn al-Din had taken him under his protection and shown him the favour and preference he offered his own sons, rather than treating him as a nephew. In doing so, he made Kadem his liege man, his blood bondsman. He fettered him with chains of steel that could never be broken. Despite that, Kadem had told Dorian at the campfire the strength of his oath to Zayn al-Din was matched only by his awareness of his duty to take vengeance on the man who had slain his father. This was a holy duty, a blood feud imposed on him by God and his own conscience. Zayn al-Din, who loved few men, loved Kadem, his nephew. He kept him close, and when he became a true warrior, he made him the commander of the royal bodyguard. Only Kadem, of the possible heirs to the caliphate, was spared from the Ramadan massacre. During the uprising that followed, Kadem had fought like a lion to protect his caliph, and in the end it was Kadem who had led Zayn al-Din through the maze of underground passages, under the palace walls to the ship waiting in the harbour of Muscat. He had carried his master safely to the palace on Lamu Island, off the Fever Coast. Kadem was the general who had overwhelmed the forts along the coast that attempted to rise in support of the revolutionary junta in Muscat. Kadem had negotiated the alliance with the English consul in Zanzibar, and Kadem had urged his master to send envoys to Constantinople and Delhi to garner support. During these campaigns along the Fever Coast, Kadem had captured most of the leaders of the factions who opposed Zayn. As a matter of course, the prisoners were handed over to his inquisitors so that they could extract from them all the information and intelligence they could. In this way, by the intelligent and judicious application of the bastinado, the screw and the garrote, the inquisitors dredged up a precious gem, the whereabouts of Al-Salil, the murderer of Pasha Abu Bakr and the sworn blood enemy of the caliph. Armed with this knowledge, Kadam pleaded with Zayn al-Din to allow him to be the instrument of retribution. Zayn consented, and Kadam would entrust his sacred duty to none of his underlings. He alone devised the stratagem of luring Al-Salil into the caliph's realm and power by impersonating an envoy of the rebel junta who still held the capital city of Muscat. When Kadam revealed his plan to Zayn al-Din, the caliph was delighted and gave the enterprise his blessing. He promised Kadam the title of Pasha, like his father before him, and any other reward Kadam could ask for if he succeeded in bringing Al-Salil and his incestuous wife Yasmini back to Lamu Island to face his wrath and retribution. Kadam asked only one reward, that when the time came for Al-Salil to die, Kadam should be given the honour of strangling him with his own hands. He promised Zayn that the garrotting would be slow and agonising. Zayn smiled and granted this boon also. Kadam had learned from the inquisitors that the trading ship Gift of Allah, which called often at the ports of the Fever Coast, belonged to Al-Salil. When next it arrived in the port of Zanzibar, Kadam inveigled himself into the confidences of Batula, Al-Salil's old lance-bearer. Kadam's plot had unfurled smoothly, until now, with the prize almost within his grasp, when he had been thwarted by Al-Salil's unfathomable refusal to accept the lure. Now Kadam had to answer the accusation of God's angel. "Highest of the high, I have indeed committed the sin of pride," Kadam made the sign of penitence by wiping his face with open hands, as though washing away the sin. "You believed that without divine intervention you alone could bring the sinner to justice. This was vanity and foolishness." The accusations thundered in his head until it felt that his eardrums must burst. Kadam bore the pain stoically. "Merciful one, it did not seem possible that any mortal man could spurn the offer of a throne." Kadam prostrated himself before the fire and the angel. "Tell me what I should do to make amends for my arrogance and stupidity. Command me, O highest of the high." There was no reply. The only sounds were the crashing of the high surf on the rocks below, and the mewing of the gulls as they circled overhead. "Speak to me, holy Gabriel," Kadam pleaded. "Do not desert me now, not after all these years when I have done as you commanded." He drew the curved dagger from his belt. It was a magnificent weapon. The blade was of Damascus steel, and the hilt was rhinoceros horn covered with pure gold filigree. Kadam pressed the point of the blade into the ball of his own thumb, and blood flowed out. "Allah! Allah!" he cried. "With this blood I entreat you, give me guidance." Only then, through his pain, the other voice spoke, not the thunder of Gabriel, but calm and measured, melodious. Kadam knew that this was the very voice of the prophet, terrible in its quiet simplicity. He trembled and listened. "You are fortunate, Kadam ibn Abu Bakr," said the prophet, "for I have listened to your confession and been moved by your cries. I will allow you one last chance of redemption." Kadam threw himself down on his face, not daring to answer that voice. It spoke again. "Kadam ibn Abu Bakr, you must wash your hands in the heart blood of the murderer of your father, the traitor and heretic, the sinner who wallows in incest, Al-Salil." Kadam beat his head against the earth, weeping for joy at the mercy the prophet had shown him. Then he sat back on his heels and held up his hand with fingers and thumb spread. The blood still dribbled from the self-inflicted wound. "God is great," he whispered. "Show me a mark of your favour, I beseech you." He stretched out his hand and held it in the leaping flames which engulfed it. "Allah," he chanted, "the one, the only." In the flames the flow of bright blood shriveled and dried. Then miraculously the wound closed like the tentacled mouth of a sea anemone. his flesh healed before his eyes. He lifted his hand out of the flame, still chanting God's praises, and held it aloft. There was no mark where the wound had been. There was no redness or blistering from the flames. His skin was smooth and flawless. It was the sign he had asked for. "God is great," he exulted. "There is no God but God, and Muhammad is his last true prophet."